Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right State Auditor John Dougal.
Hey, great to be with you. I'll be running to the bank soon.
We're all in studio together with also Shireen Gorbani on the left. Hi, Shireen.
Hello and hi, listeners. Hope you're doing well.
Lots of news this week, Shireen.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, so Natalie, as our economist here. Yeah,
resident both sides of the aisle economist.
Economist. Are we in financial collapse?
Yeah, yeah. It's so interesting.
Yes, we are.
No. I was telling a group of business leaders that this reminds me of, you know, the ketchup metaphor where you take ketchup and you're like trying to get it out and you're pounding it and you're shaking it and you get the knife out and you try and pull it out and then all of a sudden
It all comes
at once and it's messy. I feel like that's what happened, Shireen, late last week with the Silicon Valley Bank.
Okay.
You know, because we've been having all these things about leading indicators, you know, showing risk and, you know, inflationary environment, lots of uncertainty. And then we have a run on a bank.
Yeah.
Yikes.
And two collapsed.
Yeah.
So
and we had, you know, the Fed chair last week testifying about raising interest rates and trying not to break things and oops.
Yeah. So if I broke it down really quickly.
Yeah, give us a little
context. I would say is, you know, you have a very specialized bank where the depositors and the borrowers are the same people. They're tech, venture capital companies, startups.
Very, very, very single industry centric.
Yeah. They'd been under incredibly rapid growth. I actually calculated it, annual growth in excess of 25% over the last decade. So each year growing by 25%. That's hyper growth.
My understanding is 2016 had, what was it, $45 billion in assets, and now they were over $200 billion right before they collapsed.
Right. Yep, that's right.
That's a huge.
In industries like this, you burn through cash quickly because you got startups that have ideas that don't have any cash flow that you got to pay for all of the research and development and scaling.
Here's the thing. You're burning through cash, but we're having challenges, and so investors are not putting their money in startups like they were, so now they're drawing cash out of the bank to fund their operations.
Yeah. In one day, something like $42 billion was tried. That was on March 9th, trying to pull out of the bank. So, people are pulling money, and at the same time, they've got all their investments in things that require a long-term return. It's bonds and mortgage-backed securities.
That are supposedly safe and secure, but
over the long
but they're
term.
Not liquid.
Yeah, they're not.
And my understanding is they sold $21 billion in assets and lost $2 billion in that process, which telegraphed a message, which is,
insecurity.
Okay, if you're in that dire straits, what else is wrong?
Then you have somewhere around 95% of their deposits are not federally insured.
Right.
Because they're big. They're over 250,000.
From my understanding, a traditional regional bank is about 50-50.
There you go. Yeah. So you've got all sorts of things going on. You've got specialization. You've got an investment strategy that's the wrong one for a high interest rate environment. Mm-hmm. You've got deposits coming out.
And probably the wrong one for the industry you're in as well, highly sensitive to interest rates.
And so what comes to mind is, what were we thinking? What were the bank regulators thinking?
Yeah.
And so on. And so what happened? Job number one is to calm the depositors. And the Treasury and FDIC and Fed did that over the weekend.
And if you were to give them a grade, how'd they do?
I would have done the exact same thing.
Okay,
now, John,
yeah.
You might differ with me there, but you have to calm depositors. You have to restore confidence in the system. And otherwise, you're going to have a contagion effect, and there were going to be more deposits being pulled. And a bank like Chase was going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, all these other banks were going to be put in
at risk.
Yeah.
Well,
the problem I have is, okay, you made bad choices. Now everybody else has to pay the price because of your bad choices.
Yeah, but the depositors didn't make bad choices.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The depositors did not choose well in terms of one doing business with this bank. I mean, talking with somebody who had done bank business with this bank for 1 month and said, I don't think they're competent. Mm-hmm. And boom, pulled their money out and went to a different bank. And so you look and say, you're putting this in. It's not insured. You know certain risks that go with that. But now you're expecting everybody else to bail you out for your bad choices.
Yeah.
Now, granted, management made horrible choices, it looks like.
I'm waiting for Shireen to jump on John about regulatory.
Yeah, here we go.
Go, Shireen.
Okay, so I just want to start this conversation by saying what I think we have in this country often is socialism for the rich and cutthroat capitalism for the poor. And I'll give you a few examples here, right? So we had deregulation that came after. So after the financial collapse in 2008, we got Dodd-Frank, which provided greater regulation. Mm-hmm. And in 2018, so just
it
so we're clear.
Provided more regulation. I don't know if it was greater.
More regulation. And in 2018, a number of those regulations on banks like this one were pulled back. So just so we're clear, right now we're living in the consequences of Trump's America. And
exempting them from stress testing.
Yes.
Lowering their liquidity requirements, so on and so forth.
Under the argument, which is, we're not systemic. We're not big enough to matter. And yet right here we're saying they're big enough to matter.
Yes. You absolutely are. Yeah. Okay. And so I have to say, the other thing that was happening in this context is you have a bunch of very powerful people who are very online, including our governor, who jumped right into this and is tweeting and interacting with many tech leaders in our own community, who I do believe here are not the problem. The problem for me is a systemic regulatory issue where we have created an environment with a lot of risk that should have probably had more oversight, obviously. But I just want to say, at the same time that we're seeing this, we're seeing these kinds of actions around this kind of bank collapse. I just always have to remind people that Utah has the second highest payday loan rate in the nation, only behind Texas. That percentage of payday loans, right, is 652%. Those individuals who are taking payday loans are not tweeting at the governor, are not tweeting with each other. They're not on a power play of group, you know, a group chat, getting what they need to make their lives more financially sound. These kinds of powerful leaders, including people like Greg Becker, who was the CEO of this bank, did have that kind of access and do have that kind of power. And it is no surprise to me that all of these dollars, somehow we magically are able to ensure that everyone's going to get their money back.
I want to just point out the irony also of this. You mentioned Dodd-Frank. Barney Frank, what was he doing recently? He's on the board of Signature Bank, which is one of those
that just collapsed.
The weekend. And so the guy behind Dodd-Frank was involved in this activity. But I want to point out, though, on a bank run, we have fractional banking, which is there is no way to legislate to protect against a bank run in a fractional banking system. And fractional banking, if we all think back to It's a Wonderful Life, mm-hmm. which is where we learned about bank runs, okay? The bank doesn't hold all your money there. Mm-hmm. You expect to be able to pull your cash out at a moment's notice, but your money is in so-and-so's house and so-and-so's house and mm-hmm. so-and-so's business, and it's invested in all these other activities. It is not just sitting there ready for you to pull it out.
Yeah.
And when everybody goes to pull their money out, there's no cash to pay for it.
John, would you have provided this backstop for depositors of these banks, like the Fed, Treasury?
At 100%, absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
Would you, Shireen?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have too.
Yeah. Though I think
you have to contain this.
Yeah, again, we
but
need
you're
better
talking
regulation,
about containing it,
but yes.
But you're not containing it. You're kicking it to an even bigger problem down the road. Every time we say the government will bail you out, and it's not just you're going to take a haircut at 20%. Now we're going to backstop you 100% regardless of it.
I love being in the political middle because I can get the best idea from you and from Shireen. So, the system has to change. You have to change your regulation after the fact here, right? We can't let it happen again.
Yes.
We learn from it, but we can't. I think you have to provide this backstop or this week would be terrible for the economy. We would be plummeting right now.
But my point is, this is fantasy land because last time we were told we're going to put in place regulations and other things like that. And the simple fact is you can't regulate.
Okay, that we're rolled
kind of,
back.
This kind Just, of. Well, no, but you, we still have massive regulations. We still had massive regulations for banks.
Many fewer on this
type of bank. And you can't legislate away bank runs. It is a structural problem with the way we have set up banking, and you can't deregulate that away, unfortunately.
So we are both sides of the aisle program, primarily a public affairs sort of, you know, public decision, public policy thing. And we're talking about banking and economics in here. There's a reason for that because it affects everything.
Yeah.
So the Federal Open Market Committee, the Fed, meets next week. I think it's Thursday. I think it's the 22nd. What do you want them to do? The inflation numbers came out today. They were lower, 6%.
Yeah.
It had been 6.4. It dropped to 6. It's going heading in the right direction. The question is, do they pause and just not do anything? That's zero. Or do they put in what has been sort of, you know, telegraphed, a 25 basis point increase? What would
you
do?
So I would pause. Uh-huh. And I – the reason
– Wait.
I know. The reason that I feel like I would pause on this is the backdrop that we're talking about with mm-hmm. these banks, the uncertainty right now, inflation is coming down, not as quickly as they would like. We still have strong employment. Mm-hmm. I think that this would be a moment to take a breath and see what continues to happen, though I know that we're continuing to see inflation in surface area and mm-hmm. you know mm-hmm. many other areas, but in some of our key areas, it is coming down. Yeah. What would you do, Natalie?
Well, I think the Fed's in a complete pickle, right, because okay. they've got to deal with inflation. They've said things, but they have to base it on the most recent information. I think they pause. That's what I think they should do. They still might do the 25 basis points. But yeah. the pickle is that they have to think about now both inflation and a bank crisis. Now, John, would you pause? Would you 25 basis points? Would you up the ante and go 50?
Oh, since I love the Fed so much. No, I think what will they likely do? I think they'll pause.
Okay.
I think there's too great a concern from their perspective that if they raise it, it'll spook things even more and cause a bigger problem right now.
Yeah.
And they'll want to ride it for another month or two and just kind of see what shakes out.
We don't have a ton of time.
But I do want to touch on one thing.
Okay, please.
Shireen is absolutely correct about the dynamic
socialism for the rich, cutthroat capitalism for the poor, that part, or a different part?
Yeah, no. There's way too much to that. I mean, we got welfare queens that we call corporate America.
That's right.
Too many positions. So I totally agree with you on that. But you're also highlighting, from my perspective, a similar concern, which is, okay, these politically connected individuals, corporate leaders, other things like that.
Yeah.
The price is going to be paid by everyday Americans, because when we place a tax, and I think a special assessment, because we don't like the word tax, but when we start taxing the bank accounts of everyday Americans to subsidize backstopping
the bailout
for this,
it's not a taxpayer bailout on the front end, right? So basically, because of the FDIC, which when you go to your bank, you see that little FDIC insured, mm-hmm. they have a reserve, and the idea is that the people who put their money into Silicon Valley Bank will be repaid out of that fund, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm.
So all folks with bank accounts, in essence, will be...
have paid into that, right?
And will be paying into it.
Right. So now the idea is then if for some reason they wouldn't have the money to cover it, which it seems like they do in far excess, mm-hmm. then Treasury would back that in, mm-hmm. correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then...
And I think higher banking fees in the future.
Higher banking fees in the future, and that's what you're talking
about.
That's
what I'm talking
ultimately
about.
Trickling down to the everyday person.
Yeah. Yes. So politically connected, get the benefit... that everyday Americans pay.
But we don't
price.
Know if that is what's going to happen yet. But I think it's possible. But
I was going to transition something else.
Yeah.
But since we got so deep into this, what's the local impact here? So Silicon Valley Bank has a physical address in Utah. I think it's out in Cottonwood Heights. So that's interesting. They're here. They're present in our state. I looked up the numbers. Tech industry is about 18% of the Utah economy, 18% of GDP. And that's taking both direct and indirect, kind of looking at it. Annual employment growth of 4.9% over the last decade. Nationally, it was 1.4. So it's on the rise here. We're a rising tech center. Zion's Bank. Don't like listening to CNBC and hear them saying Zion's. Both because they can't say the name, but you don't want Zion's Bank being talked about in this thing.
As a big regional bank.
Yeah. Wait, how do you read it, Shireen and John? And all I'm meaning is, what's the local risk here? What should listeners be thinking about?
So I don't know, and it's impossible for me to say, but I do think that the connection that we have that you just outlined between how fast tech is growing in our state and how central a bank like Zions is to the kind of broader financial environment in Utah. I can understand how we're in this ecosystem,
mm-hmm. yeah.
but I don't feel comfortable saying anything else.
And I have to be careful
because
I don't know a lot either, but
yeah.
I think that Zions is a victim here. I think Zions is well-diversified geographically, industry-wise, has a lot of their deposits insured. They use the term granular, meaning they have a lot of small accounts. And I just think they're being lumped in, but that's me.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that's kind of the dynamic, which is what usually happens here is people overreact, and all of a sudden they start looking and seeing – problems everywhere, whether or not they truly exist. And so because Zions is a large regional bank, boom, this was a regional bank, and regional banks were not supposed to have this kind of impact, and they get sucked in on it.
Listeners, in our second segment, we have a lot of things that don't deal with the Fed and monetary policy, so stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani, on the left.
John Dougal, on the right.
Natalie Gochner, I'm in the political center, and this is both sides of the aisle. We are having a fun time.
I was going to say, did you have to think about that? Because maybe you're closer to me today.
It's both sides of the economy today, but we did get President Biden's budget. Let's just spend just a second on it. $6.8 trillion budget. It's for the 2024 fiscal year. He wants to raise taxes on wealthy individuals and corporations and then have Medicare negotiate drug prices. Those are his revenue streams. John, I'm assuming you are just not liking that at all.
Well, I mean, the headlines we're talking about, he's going to close the deficit by $3 trillion versus $4.7 trillion tax increases.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, you're increasing taxes that much and you still can't close a deficit? I mean, we got such a spending problem back there, and pretending like raising more taxes is going to fix it is just fantasy land.
I think it's super convenient for, you know, left of center people to say raise taxes on the rich and act like there's not a cost to that, Shereen.
Okay, so
she's loaded, John.
Let's raise taxes on the rich, to be clear. But I do think that there.
No, so this if is we on are, everybody.
If we are going to be serious, though, about the deficit, then there does have to be a
revenue component.
A revenue component.
I'm with you there.
And we are talking about increasing in this budget, in Biden's budget, increasing military spending. We're also talking about greater investments here at home. And that means things like the child tax credit, which has been largely popular when we've talked about it here before, free school meals, thinking about paid family leave, universal preschool, some of these things that are really important to me, that I think are important to a lot of working Americans. And if we are going to talk about reducing the deficit along with protecting Medicare, that is broadly popular, right? The question that I think this begs is, let's see the Republican budget. Let's see what the proposal is from Kevin McCarthy. I can't wait to find out how they're going to come to the table with an argument, a vision for how we should spend and tax in this country, what that should actually look like, that does anything better than this does. And frankly, what we saw when Republicans were in control were major handouts, tax breaks to the rich that were totally unfunded that have gotten us further into debt. So I think we should have the argument. I would like to see the Republican budget.
John Biden saying he's ready to negotiate with Speaker McCarthy.
I hope they negotiate. I do hope the Republicans have a good plan as well.
Yeah.
But I do want to highlight.
They don't.
This is when Shereen says this is only a tax on the wealthy. I'll point out right here. One of the simple ones, you look at the corporate rate increase. Corporations don't pay taxes. People pay taxes. Customers, employees, shareholders. And it all depends on the nature of the business. But this goes across essentially all Americans. This is not just targeted at some kind of wealthy thing. And when people talk about that, it tries to pitch a world that doesn't exist.
Okay,
but
in the Trump administration, we saw the decrease of that tax on corporate entities, which I get is people, from 28% down to 21%. Can you tell me that that has actually done anything to address this problem of spending and deficit? It has not. So I don't understand why we have to keep having this argument when we have the data that says it didn't.
I'm coming partly from the perspective where President Biden said, I'm only going to raise taxes on people making more than $400K. And then it was couples making more than $400K. And then it's reality. No, I want to tax everybody. And I want to pretend like I'm not taxing everybody.
So we are already taxed, to be clear.
It is not just President Biden that plays this game.
Yeah.
Congress plays this game all the time, trying to pretend like other people are paying the taxes when really it's not.
Nikki Haley is interesting to me here. She's obviously a candidate for president, former governor of South Carolina, ambassador to the UN under Trump. She's basically, I don't know if you all saw it, but she said that she's willing to talk about retirement age for Social Security. And this is where I think there's ground to be made up, that if you're in your 20s, we're going to change Social Security for you.
And we've talked about this,
because that's an expenditure thing, a reform thing.
Biden and the Republicans took it hook, line, and sinker, getting them to commit to not making any change. And I think there needs to be, I think, judicious changes
to fix
the retirement age.
Stay with Nikki Haley with me for a minute. She's interesting. She made the comment that she thinks to run for, I don't know if it was federal office, but I think it was, that she wants a mental competency test for people over 75.
Yeah.
and what, we have Mitch McConnell, who's had this fall and this concussion. He's 81. Just to give our listeners something.
I'm not that old.
President Trump is 76, so he was over 75. Senator Romney's 76.
Yeah.
Biden, 80. Is that what we decided?
Just turned 80.
Clever.
Is it?
Clever. Well, She's doing ageism in a clever way.
She's doing ageism in a clever way. Yeah. I just don't think I wish that we did have some sort of competency test for people. But I also have to ask, like, what would that look like? And what would it mean to do that in a way that understands that, you know, sometimes people stay very sharp, very far into their aging process. I think it's ageist.
Yeah. John, any comment on Nikki Haley and picking on people that are seniors?
She clearly is coming from a perspective which is she's younger and new generation. She's got to figure out angles of attack, and that's a good angle of attack. And depending on the individual, as they age, as Shireen wisely mentioned, you know, some age differently than others. And so some have their mental capacities into the 100 years old, and others in their 70s, 80s, they're rapidly losing it.
Driver's license, you take a vision test to be in federal office, you got to...
I'll point out, though, some people question, even the fact you're running for office calls into question your mental competency.
You got it. All right. Let's run through a couple of quick local issues. I want to start with the flag referendum. This was SB 31. Our good friend Senator Dan McKay has been such a leader on it. We've got Chad Saunders, I believe it is, who's leading this effort for referendum. John, I don't think this can happen. I don't think they'll get the signatures, but...
Well, I ran into Chad on Saturday at a Republican event, and so it's interesting the pitch that they're giving, which is, you know, we just want Utahns to decide. So sign the referendum. You agree, disagree, doesn't matter. Just sign it so you can put it to a vote and let the Utah citizens decide.
And Shireen, I think they'll have an easy time getting tons of signatures in urban Utah. It's just that's not how referendum law works in this state. They have to get signatures all around the state, and it's going to be harder than they think.
That is right. So they need to be active voters in 15 of our 29 Senate districts, and that is not easy. And it is 134,298 signatures. That is a boatload.
Yeah. Shireen, let's stay with you. Wendover City's of interest. This is West Wendover City, I guess. They Planned Parenthood, others talked about having an abortion clinic there. It'd be 2 hours or less from the urban center here. Yeah. I guess the city council didn't go for it, but give us the dynamics of state boundaries and abortion in our state.
Yeah. So we're headed into a terribly dark time where people's access to their reproductive choices are going to likely to be severely limited. I will say it's still legal and safe up to 18 weeks in Utah. But basically what's happening all around the country is that there's sort of a map of those places that are on the border where people can access the kind of, you know, reproductive health care that they're trying to get that they may need, right? And how it might, you know, be at an intersection of a state like Nevada, where it is protected, and a place like Idaho and Utah, where it is definitely not. So there are all of these different locations cropping up around the country that are being looked at as places where we may see clinics, you know, come into being.
John, you're welcome to weigh in on that. But I wanted to ask you about the Farmington police shooting and the body cam videos and just the terribly tragic event that happened there.
Yeah, it's a tragic event, and it's one of those things. Whenever you have these tragic events, sometimes, well, some folks will just jump on what they see initially, and there's usually more complexity on both sides of what was taking place and what folks were experiencing and stuff like that. And that's what's one of the things that's so challenging. I mean, as an auditor, I don't just get a voice, here's what I think the outcome of the audit should be. We got to go through all the work of the audit. Even things that look fairly simple are oftentimes more complex than they appear.
Yeah. The listeners, if you haven't watched the video, you see it from both sides, from the standpoint of you see a very professional police officer trying his best to enforce the laws and doing what he's doing. And then you see a young man that philosophically has some ideas. But the tricky thing is he's got a gun and a holster, and it's right where the seatbelt unlock is.
Yeah.
And so at this critical moment in time, you don't know what he's doing. And these officers have families, have to protect their lives. It's so sad.
And some people don't know this concept of a sovereign citizen. They come from the perspective which they are not subject to the laws of the state of Utah or the U.S. government and stuff like that. And so they feel like they're completely independent.
Yeah, but they drive on our roads and they use our resources. And I think that it's a terribly tragic situation. I don't understand how we continue to live in a world where traffic stops can end like this.
Yeah. John, do you have any insight on this former Juab County clerk that's under investigation for alleged election offenses?
I don't. I mean, I know her. I know she's not currently in office. I know she didn't run for re-election. I don't know the issues. When I've talked with her in the past, it was on financial matters. I've never talked with her about election issues, and I don't know the behind the scenes what the issue is.
The fact that it's gotten to the level it's at, and our Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson weighing in, tells me it's serious.
Yeah.
I feel the same.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, you feel the same. Shireen, any other local news you wanted to highlight?
Well, I guess I would just say the thing that I'm grateful for is the increased warm weather, but that does mean that we're seeing runoff. And please go out and clean those drains that you see around your neighborhood because they need to be open to receive the rainwater.
Yeah.
John? Not for the to-do list on Saturday. She wants you to do it today.
I want you to do it now.
The governor's got, I don't know, 60 days to sign bills. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
And so,
but he's got, yeah, towards the end of the month. I mean, he's got 3 weeks or so to sign bills, and then they go into effect 60 days after the session.
So for our listeners, we'll keep you posted on what the bill signings are looking like and if there's going to be a veto this session. Well, it's been a lively conversation, everyone. Natalie Gochner in the Political Center with John Dougal and Shireen Gourbani. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for your interest. Thanks for listening.